Hello, shalom. My name is Nachum Amozel, and this podcast is What Does Judaism Say About? This is the full podcast. Today's topic is the Jewish view of holiness. Achieving holiness is a goal of almost every major religion in the world, but the definition of holiness differs from religion to religion. In Judaism, we will see that there are numerous definitions of holiness. Unlike most religions that demand holiness only from its leaders, Judaism demands holiness from each and every Jew. One of the goals of Judaism, says the Torah, is to have an entire nation of Jewish people, stated by God immediately prior to the giving of the Torah. There is a specific biblical commandment for each person, each Jew, to be holy. This was only one of two commandments in the entire Torah, specifically given to the entire people gathered at once. But how is this holiness to be achieved? What exactly is Jewish holiness? And can this be attained in the 21st century, in a modern society, if at all? If so, how? One of the general aspects of Jewish holiness is that it depends not upon a specific action that is performed, but rather within the proper time, the proper place, and proper purpose surrounding that action. The very same action can be holy or unholy, depending on the factors of time, place, and purpose. In fact, the Torah's word for prostitute is kedesha, which has precisely the same four letters and seems to be derived from the same root as kedusha, Hebrew word for holiness. Thus, the sexual act itself is neither holy nor unholy. If sex is performed with a stranger for money, it is abhorrent in Judaism and certainly unholy. But the very same act with one's spouse at the correct time of the month converts a person into a partner with God, says the Talmud, in the creation process, the holiest act of all. In another obvious example, a Jew drinks wine to get high or to become drunk and have fun on a weeknight, commits a truly unholy act. But the very same action on a Friday evening, performed for the purpose of making the Sabbath day holy and not merely to feel high, is called kiddush, also derived from the word for holiness itself. These are but two examples of many that can be demonstrated. When King Solomon in Ecclesiastes wrote that everything has its proper time, he meant precisely this. Nothing is totally forbidden in Judaism, precisely because no action in and of itself is good or bad. Thus, every action in this world has a time and a place in Judaism when it is permitted. This fact alone corroborates the postulate that it is the circumstances surrounding the act that make it either good or bad, holy or unholy. The Talmud expands on this theme when it says that for everything forbidden in Judaism, there is a time and a place that it is permitted. Some of the examples cited in the Talmud are the taste of pork that is permitted to the Jew in the form of the shibuta fish that is kosher and has the same taste as pork. Thus, the taste itself is not forbidden. Similarly, the taste of meat and milk together is not forbidden and is permitted to the Jew in the form of the udder of the cow, which apparently tastes like milk and meat together. If prepared properly under Jewish law, the udder is kosher meat and yet retains the taste of milk within the meat. The passage continues with other examples. Though wool and linen are forbidden to be worn in the same garment, the garment of the high priest in the temple did contain wool and linen together. Even adultery is permitted in Judaism in the proper circumstances. Normally, a man and his sister-in-law are prohibited from cohabiting according to Jewish law. However, when a husband dies childless, it is a biblical commandment for the brother of the deceased husband to marry that widow in order to carry on the name of the deceased husband and brother and have a child, and not for the purpose of committing adultery. This then becomes a holy action, yibum, rather than a sin. Therefore, Holiness, according to this understanding, is achieved by performing the right action at the right time for the right purpose. That makes the action holy. Another approach to holiness in Judaism is the one most people usually explain when asked to describe this concept. This is the view of Rashi, who describes holiness in his commentary to that verse in the Torah which commands Jews to be holy. Rashi says the commandment signifies abstaining from illicit sexual activity. It seems from Rashi that one achieves holiness in Judaism by refraining from those activities forbidden to the Jew. This is similar to the classic Christian definition of holiness, that the more one denies bodily pleasure, the more one becomes holy. But long before Christianity began, this concept already existed in Judaism. As noted above, the illicit sexual activity with a prostitute is associated philologically with the Hebrew term for holiness. Similarly, the Torah states that the purpose of the laws of kashrut, keeping kosher, are to attain holiness. Thus, abstention from two basic drives of man, sex and food, lead a person to holiness according to this concept of kedusha. There is a third approach to holiness that directly challenges this classical notion of kedusha. To understand it, it is necessary to first understand holiness as defined by two other cultures. In the Greek culture, beauty and sanctification of the human body were the ultimate religious values in that society, not merely the cultural values. Thus, holiness in that society was achieved when the body was most satisfied. Therefore, at that time, food orgies and sex orgies had as their origin and ultimate purpose the fulfillment of the religious concept to satisfy the body in order to attain holiness. They were not merely the fun concepts that they are associated with today. As the body became more and more satisfied, the ancient Greeks believed they were acting holier and holier. As noted above, Christianity reacted to this concept but went all the way by insisting that what separates man from the beast is his soul. What makes man similar to the beast is his body. Therefore, in classic Christianity, holiness could be achieved by denying the body totally and nourishing only the soul. This was the Christian definition of holiness, which called for the holiest Christians, such as the priest and the pope, to abstain totally from any sexual activity, unlike Rashi's definition of holiness. Monks took vows of poverty and silence, denying the body as much pleasure as possible, while concentrating only on spiritual matters. Normative Judaism realizes that neither the Greek nor the Christian paths alone could achieve true holiness, as man is made up of both the body and the soul, and each has legitimate needs. Thus, denying the body totally was not realistic or desired, and could not achieve true holiness. Yet, man also could not deny his spiritual side at the same time, acknowledging that while he was created from the dust of the earth, very unholy, he was also created in the image of God, in the image of holiness. How could both be achieved simultaneously? This approach to Jewish holiness believes that the needs of the body should indeed be satisfied, but only for a spiritual purpose. By using the physical enjoyment of the body as a means to honor God, then that act becomes holy. One example already cited is the Shabbat Kiddush. To the non-Jewish world, wine is the symbol of the lack of inhibition, the lack of spirituality that brings out animalistic sides of man. Yet the body's natural desire for wine can be fulfilled by drinking wine on Friday night, but only if one's purpose is to honor the Shabbat. If it is not for this purpose, then even if it's on Friday night, it is not truly Kiddush holiness. Similarly, the ingestion of nourishment is a very basic bodily process that every being in the world shares. Judaism raises the act of eating to something holy by selecting only those foods as permitted by God, and by acknowledging God each time a food is eaten in the form of a blessing. Of all the subjects that Maimonides could have selected for his Book of Holiness, one of the 14 books of Jewish law in his Mishneh Torah, he selected only two topics: the laws of permitted and forbidden sexual activity, and the laws of permitted and forbidden food. Thus, Maimonides too is demonstrating that one becomes holy in Judaism by satisfying man's physical needs only through a spiritual purpose. Nowhere is this concept more apparent than in the entire view of Shabbat. Holiness is first mentioned in the Torah with regard to the Shabbat during creation. Besides the Kiddush, there are specific actions which traditional Jews do every Shabbat that make it holy. Of all the actions done on Shabbat, they have one thing in common. They fulfill the physical desires of man, performed for the purpose of making the day of Shabbat holy. In addition to the wine, Jews make Shabbat holy by preparing and eating the best food of the week, and by dressing up in the finest clothes of the week. The Talmud also says that it is a mitzvah commandment to wash one's body in preparation for Shabbat. All these actions show that the Shabbat is made holy through activities that satisfy bodily needs for a spiritual purpose. In the portion of Leviticus called Kiddushim, named for that commandment, be holy, Kiddushim tihyu, which begins that portion, the rest of the commandments which immediately follow are, by and large, not what we would think as holy, but rather everyday activities, most of which take place in the marketplace. These include love your neighbor as yourself, do not steal, do not place an object before a blind person, do not withhold gifts to the poor, etc. According to one Talmudic opinion, a person achieves piety by learning the laws relating to the marketplace and the laws of damages. Thus, holiness once again seems to be achieved in Judaism in the physical world by making physical activities into spiritual acts and not the other way around. This entire approach is encapsulated in the one phrase from the Talmud, make yourself holy through that which is permitted to you. These two classical Jewish approaches, achieving holiness through abstention, Rashi, and achieving holiness by sanctifying the physical fulfillment of bodily desires, Maimonides, are both legitimate and have been argued by Jewish law authorities throughout the ages. The controversy still continues today. Both refer to bodily desires such as sex and food, one claiming the abstention achieves the holiness, and the other asserting that the fulfillment under the proper circumstances and purpose achieves the holiness. Perhaps the classical mitzvah, which typifies this clash of the two views, is that of the Nazir, the Nazirite, the Jew who voluntarily abstains from wine, abstains from cutting his hair, and also abstains from coming in contact with the dead, a cemetery, which are all beyond normative Jewish law. One Talmudic approach is that indeed the Nazir is holy because he chose to abstain from more prohibitions than everyone else. The other opinion in the Talmud is that the Nazir is wrong in his actions because he chose to deny himself some of the actions which God permitted him. This argument about the Nazir continued into the Middle Ages. At the end of the period of abstention, usually 30 days of that Nazir, the Torah commands the Nazir to bring sacrifices, and one of the sacrifices is a sin offering. Maimonides uses this sin offering as proof that the Torah looks at the Nazir as a sinner, because he should not have taken that oath to begin with. Maimonides continues to rail against the entire philosophy of fasting when not necessary and not commanded, and using other denials of action by Jews in order to achieve holiness. As a perversion of the intended Torah path, says Maimonides, quoting the verse admonishing the Jew not to be too righteous. Nachmanides, who believes the Nazir's act to be praised, explains that the reason for the sin offering is because when the person stopped becoming a Nazir, he lowered himself from a higher status of holiness to a lower status. In fact, the Torah does indeed call the Nazir holy. According to Maimonides and his camp, the only reason the Torah permitted the concept of Nazir is that it recognizes that there are some misguided individuals in every society, in every age, who think that they can become holy by denying themselves more and more than is required. Rather than letting these people go on their own, as is often the case, where individuals have improper tendencies, the Torah takes these legitimate feelings and channels them into an acceptable and legitimate Torah structure called the Nazir. Thus, the lines of both sides are clearly drawn. There are numerous Talmudic statements supporting both opinions. On the one hand, the Talmud says that a person will have to answer in heaven for all the permitted things he could have partaken of in this world, but did not. On the other hand, there is a conflicting statement that says anyone who denies himself pleasure in this world will receive added pleasures in the next world, and conversely, he who partakes in physical pleasures in this world will be denied certain pleasures in the next world. Thus, the argument is still not resolved, but both approaches are authentically Jewish. Yet another approach is offered by Nachmanides, Ramban, in defining precisely what is meant in the commandment to be holy. Rather than one specific action, Nachmanides writes that this commandment is an overarching mitzvah commandment that teaches the Jew an overall approach to life. There are numerous laws that a Jew might be able to observe meticulously within the letter of the law and yet still act in an improper, unholy manner. Thus, Nachmanides calls this person a disgusting person within permission of the Torah. Naval b'rishut ha-Torah. The general commandment to be holy, according to Nachmanides, commands the Jew that even when other Torah laws do not specifically prohibit a behavior, that specific behavior is indeed still forbidden under this commandment if common sense says that it is not in the spirit of the law. An example that he gives is the Jew who follows all the kosher laws strictly and pronounces a blessing over each and every food, but then proceeds to gorge himself in a disgusting, animalistic manner. Holiness, according to Nachmanides, forbids this practice, even though no specific law has been violated. Thus, a person is admonished not to just go by the letter of the Jewish law, but also must be cognizant of the spirit of the law as well. That is true Jewish holiness. The analogy has been made to the physical Torah itself, which is made up of a scroll of the letters of the Torah written in black ink, surrounded by the white parchment. The specific laws are delineated by the black ink in the words of the Torah, but the white surround is also part of that Torah. This symbolizes the spirit of the Torah, the context in which the black letters delineate the mitzvot. Thus, both a violation of the letter and the spirit of the law is a violation of the Torah and the commandment to be holy. Finally, there is a special kind of holiness that Jews are also commanded to fulfill, making God's name holy. God equates Jews becoming holy with his own holiness, and the commandment to be holy stems from God's holiness. Thus, part of a Jew's holiness is attained by making God's name holy. In addition, there is both a positive commandment to actively make God's name holy and a negative commandment not to desecrate God's name with actions performed by the Jew. This is achieved in the way in which a Jew behaves on an individual basis in daily life with all of his or her activities. If by a Jew's actions people will think better of the Jewish God, that is a sanctification of God's name, making it holy. If, however, people will think worse of the Jewish God because of the action of a particular individual, then that person has desecrated the name and the holiness of God. Thus, holiness of a person is also reflected in how people perceive God because of the actions of that individual. Therefore, these are the five views of Jewish holiness. The importance of all these concepts and the power of holiness in the world can be seen from one unique event in the Jewish calendar that used to take place every single year. The Talmud says that there are many lands in this world, but only one Israel is called holy. There are many holy cities within the Holy Land, but only one city is called the holiest, Jerusalem. There are many places within Jerusalem that are holy, but only one place, the Temple Mount, is the holiest of holy. Similarly, there are many peoples in the world, but only one, the Jewish people, is called holy. Within the Jewish people, the Levites are the holiest of the tribes. And within the Levites, one family, the Kohanim, the priests, are holier still. And the holiest of the Kohanim is the high priest, the holiest person in the world. Similarly, there are many days during the year, but the 40 days from the beginning of the month of Elul through Yom Kippur are the holiest, when prayers to God are more accepted by him. Within this time period, the 10 days of repentance from Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur are holier still. And the holiest day of all is Yom Kippur, while the holiest moment of Yom Kippur occurs right after the sacrifices of the atonement were brought by the high priest when the temple stood, the holiest moment of the year. So too, there are many languages spoken in the world, but only one Hebrew is called the holy tongue. Within Hebrew, there are many words, but the holiest words are the names of God. Within the many names of God, there is only one, the name that is not pronounced, Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey, which is the holiest word in the world. When all four of these forces of holiness are unleashed together, the power is indescribable. During the time of the temple, when the holiest person, the high priest, stood in the temple, that holiest place, at the holiest moment of Yom Kippur, and pronounces that unpronounceable name of God, the holiest word, all the forces of holiness combine to effect atonement for the entire Jewish people. Such is the power of holiness. Thank you for listening and giving of your time. If you'd like to respond or react to any of the points discussed, feel free to write about it on the group Facebook page, What Does Judaism Say About?, or more privately by email at whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. That's one word, whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. In addition, if you'd like to receive a full transcript of this podcast, feel free to email me. Please subscribe to the weekly podcast so that you will not miss even one topic. Shalom.